The following episode of K-Voice was recorded at 1:34 a.m.
July 21st,
2017. Things may have changed by the time you listen to this show. Enjoy the show.
Hello. Thank you for listening to K-Voice of Resistance. I'm Kelly the Voice. This is my 50th episode. I can hardly believe it. 50 episodes of politics, rants, activist tears, hopes, fears, stupid sound effects, and you guys. Thanks for all the listens, all the feedback, and all the downloads. When I started this thing, I was desperate to find a way to survive these 4 years without winding up in a padded room. And through activism, and through this show, I've mostly maintained my mental health. All right. Let's get to the news. Republicans in the House. You know, I swear that every modern horror story begins with Republicans in the House. Anyway, Republicans in the House hate bald eagles. They hate them. I don't have any other explanation for their current efforts. They hate bald eagles. Animals in general. They want to kill them dead. Republican leaders in the House Natural Resources Committee pushed through 5 bills that seek to gut the Endangered Species Act. Is this something that people are calling for? The bills call for reviews of the economic cost of adding a name to the endangered species list, to not allow non-native species to be added to the list, and caps an attorney's fees in endangered species cases, which those of us that oppose this effort say that it would reduce public access to the courts. They do know that extinction is forever, right? No. They know. They just don't care. You know, things are really screwed up when I and the potentially most conservative justice on the Supreme Court agree on something. On this next issue, I and Clarence Thomas fall in line. You see, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, the hood-wearing lawn gnome who somehow landed a big boy job at the Klan headquarters, formerly known as the White House, wants to steal your stuff, and has decided to give an elf-sized middle finger to states' rights, and announced Wednesday that he'll be reinstating adoptive seizure programs, which allow local and state law enforcement to seize assets under federal guidelines as opposed to more restrictive state guidelines. Essentially, the Justice Department is allowing the police to take your stuff, simply if they think you've done something wrong, or choose to say they think you've done something wrong, and never give it back. See, he thinks that incentivizing cops to take people's homes, cars, money, etc. for themselves is a great way to keep the poor and darker-skinned citizens down. And you know what? He's right. It's very effective. What it is not effective at is stopping crime. And I'm pretty sure that's not his main goal here, is it? So here's the deal. Countable explains that asset forfeiture is the confiscation of assets by the government. The purpose is supposed to be to disrupt criminal activity by confiscating assets that potentially could have been beneficial to the individual or organization. Sessions is calling for adoptive forfeiture, where the federal government claims, or adopts the assets and then shares them to local jurisdictions. Typically, the local jurisdictions get approximately 80% of the value and the federal government gets no more than 20%. The Washington Post explained, quote, 13 states have passed laws requiring prosecutors to obtain a criminal conviction before authorities can permanently seize an individual's property. Under federal law, however, authorities can take cash, vehicles, homes, and any other property and keep it for themselves without ever charging the suspect with a crime, unquote. This is ridiculous. And as I've said before, the Supreme Court's sexual harasser falls on the right side of this issue, saying, quote, this system where police can seize property with limited judicial oversight and retain it for their own use has led to egregious and well-chronicled abuses. These forfeiture operations frequently target the poor and other groups least able to defend their interest in forfeiture proceedings, unquote. Jefferson Beauregard Sessions' war on drugs is ramping up nicely. In just half a year, he is unwinding 8 years of progress like a champ. And while the House and the Senate may hit roadblocks, we have had a demolished EPA, eviscerated foreign relations, trashed regulations protections. Pretty soon, we'll have mandatory hunting of endangered species. Everyone gets a gun requirement, illegal smog test, chastity belts for women, child labor, and Christianity will be a mandatory religion. What can we do? Contact our representatives. Tell them that these, quote, protections that Sessions claims to have put in the policy to fix its problems don't go far enough to protect citizens' rights.
I've been saying that, Mike, I think you'll agree, for a long time. Let Obamacare fail. It'll be a lot easier. And I think we're probably in that position where we'll just let Obamacare fail. We're not going to own it. I'm not going to own it. I can tell you the Republicans are not going to own it.
Okay. Time for our obligatory chat about healthcare. Presuming man who forgot his shell at home, Mitch McConnell's desperate attempt to strip what the CBO says will be 32 million people off healthcare will be a failure, and he won't be able to repeal Obamacare without a replacement, we have a new host of problems on our hands. Donnie and a large portion of the GOP in office want to tank Obamacare because playing fast and loose with people's lives is as fun as golf for these men. And here are the ways Countable explains that can be done. He can end the individual mandate. See, on Wednesday, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated what would happen if Obamacare were to be repealed without a replacement. The CBO predicts that 32 million people would lose insurance by 2026, including 17 million by next year. The CBO also estimated that compared to current law, premiums would nearly double by 2026, and Medicaid expansion would end by 2020. Well, much of this was based on the elimination of the individual mandate, which requires that all Americans sign up for healthcare regardless of age. By repealing the individual mandate, those who would most likely remain enrolled in healthcare would be those Americans with an immediate healthcare need, primarily older and sicker Americans. That demographic is the costliest to cover, so this, in turn, would cause insurers to have to dramatically raise their rates. So Donald and his peeps could undo the mandate and tank healthcare for millions.
You suck!
Another tactic they could use is to withhold payments to. This is one of the most lethal strategies, and has been one referred to as the nuclear option for killing Obamacare. See, insurance companies are owed billions of dollars in cost-sharing reduction payments. Under the ACA, insurance companies reduced the deductibles of low-income customers with the understanding that the government would reimburse them. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, in 2016, the federal government paid an estimated $7 billion in cost-sharing payments on behalf of 6.4 million marketplace customers. Withhold those payments, and you tank Obamacare. They can also fail to promote the open enrollment period. They already tried this. With few exceptions, individuals can only change their insurance or sign up for new insurance during the market's open enrollment period. President Obama made it a priority to spread the word about open enrollment and get people signing up. This included commercials, tweets, and offbeat interviews, including this one on Between Two Ferns.
What we want is for people to know that you can get affordable health care. Most young Americans, right now, they're not covered. And the truth is that they can get coverage, all for what it costs you to pay your cell phone bill.
Is this what they mean by drones?
The point is that a lot of young people, they think they're invincible.
Did you say invisible? Because
No.
Think, like, that's impossible.
Not invisible, invincible.
Okay.
Meaning that they don't think they can get hurt.
I'm just saying that nobody could be invisible if you had said invisible.
I understand that.
By refusing to promote the exchanges or directing people to sign up, Donald's administration could cause a steep decline in new enrollees. It's a more roundabout way of attacking the individual mandate, but one that will cause insurers to take a hit nonetheless. Well, Obamacare may not be the disaster that Donald claims it to be. It is in a precarious position. As Countable says, quote, if the ACA is a game of Jenga, Trump certainly has ways to remove some key blocks to help it tumble. The people want bipartisanship, and in huge majorities. According to an Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research survey, released Wednesday, 8 in 10 people think Republicans should offer to negotiate the healthcare issue with Democrats if their effort fails. And 9 in 10 said Democrats should come to the table if Republicans are willing. Just 27% of Republicans want to immediately repealed. Yet, they move forward, eyes closed to the numbers, hearts closed to the people, and ears closed to their panicked cries.
It's not a political outcome, it's a human outcome.
Okay, let's talk about something good. There is a surprising act of bipartisanship going on in the Senate. Senator Lindsey, get my mint julep, Graham, Republican from South Carolina, and Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, introduced a new version of the DREAM Act, granting legal status and a path to citizenship to undocumented immigrants who were brought to the country as children. This does not make Donnie happy.
But it makes me happy.
The bipartisan bill is likely to receive support from Democrats and moderate Republicans alike, pushing to provide a permanent legislative solution before any legal challenge against DACA takes effect. After all, even Republicans are on the record for their support of making DACA benefits permanent and have supported previous iterations of the DREAM Act dating back to 2001. We have more good news. We have a victory in the courts. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe won a significant victory on its fight to protect the tribe's drinking water and ancestral lands in the Dakota Access Pipeline. A federal judge ruled that the federal permits authorizing the pipeline to cross the Missouri River just upstream of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, which Donald's administration rammed through just after the inauguration, violated the law. Ha! As Donald is known to do. In a 91-page decision, Judge James Boasberg wrote, quote, "The court agrees that the corps did not adequately consider the impacts of an oil spill on fishing rights, hunting rights, and environmental justice, or the degree to which the pipeline's effects are likely to be highly controversial." Unquote. What we don't know yet is whether the pipeline operations will be shut off, and the judge has requested additional briefing on the subject and a status conference next week. Okay, we have new nominations. Continuing his thread of sarcastic government appointments, Donald's expected pick for wage chief was sued for stiffing house cleaners. Cheryl Stanton is her name, and she has been chosen to lead the agency that enforces federal wage and overtime laws, holding employers accountable when they cheat workers. Stanton served in the George W. Bush administration as the White House principal legal liaison to the Labor Department. She spent years defending companies in labor cases. She currently serves on the board in South Carolina Chamber of Commerce.
Fantastic.
And we have a new pick to the ambassador of Russia. And he seems to be on the up and up. Nothing curious about this choice whatsoever.
Just kidding.
Utah governor and former ambassador to China and just for men's hair model, John Huntsman Jr. is the lucky winner of the ambassadorship. John has ties to Russia.
Of course he does.
Through his seat on Chevron's board and his family's woodland-based business. According to the Houston Chronicle, Chevron has business dealings in Russia with state-owned Transneft, which has been targeted with sanctions by the U.S. in recent years. Lifting those sanctions would benefit Chevron.
Of course.
But don't worry, in case you were thinking that he may actually be qualified for the job, you can relax on that account too. He neither speaks Russian, nor does he have experience in Russia. Donald is nothing if not consistent. Up next, in the nothing to see here, move along section of the show, we have a new pick to be Secretary of the U.S. Army, Mark Esper. Mark Esper is a current Raytheon executive.
Raytheon. Customer success is our mission.
What is Raytheon, you ask? Well, It is the kind of company that has a vested interest in having reasons to blow things up. Raytheon manufactures missiles and other weapons, as well as provides various other defense services. For example, remember when Donald became president by making things go boom in April after the still unproven gas attack in Syria?
What changed last night?
I think Donald Trump became president of the United States.
There's a new sheriff in town, and you know what? The new sheriff wants to look like RoboCop compared to the last one.
I think that the moment when someone becomes president of the United States is the moment when they first really use American military might.
That is a decisive use of American power.
Every time this idiot Trump doesn't crap his pants or pay one of his companies another $1 million of taxpayer money, apparently that makes him Abraham goddamn Lincoln.
Thank you, Olbermann. 59 missiles were fired into a Syrian military base in retaliation, and those missiles were Raytheon's. Fortune magazine reported that the morning after the strike, Raytheon and other defense companies experienced a surge in their stock prices. They reported, quote, "The Tomahawk missile used in the strike is made by Raytheon, whose stock opened up at 2.5% higher Friday, adding more than $1 billion to the defense contractor's market capitalization," unquote. It is not only Syria that has been good for the defense industry. The Saudi arms deal also gave a nice boost to defense stocks. Citizen Truth summarized the situation like this, quote, "Mr. Esper's role at Raytheon was vice president of government relations, hence he's a lobbyist for war. His job was to make money for Raytheon by persuading government to adopt policies in Raytheon's best interest. Raytheon makes money when the U.S. government buys weapons from them, which only happens if the U.S. is continually at war. While Mr. Esper may technically sever ties to the private defense industry, clearly he goes into the U.S. military position with a pro-war bias. A lifetime spent lobbying and making friends and connection in the corporate defense industry does not simply disappear with a new job post. What the American people now have is a U.S. Army secretary with a bias towards war and generating revenue and profits for defense contractors. Once again, the U.S. government and our tax money is just a cash machine for wealthy and influential corporations," unquote. America is creating more terrorists. America is slaughtering innocents, our idiot country, that, with the help of a broken system, recklessly voted in a racist child with a temper problem, has blood on its hands. Civilian casualties from the U.S.-led war in the so-called Islamic State are on pace to double under our current president, the Tangerine Queen, according to an Air Wars investigation for the Daily Beast. Air Wars researchers estimate that under Obama, roughly 203,000 civilians likely died from coalition strikes. That's roughly 80 each month in Iraq and Syria. Well, as of July 13th, more than 2,200 additional civilians appear to have been killed by U.S.-led coalition raids since Donald was inaugurated. That's upwards of 360 per month, or more than 12 civilians killed for every day of this administration. Belkis Willey, Iraqi researcher for Human Rights Watch, had this to say, quote, "Remarkably, when I interview families at camps who have just fled the fighting, the first thing they complain about is not the three horrific years they spent under ISIS or the last months of no food or clean water, but the American airstrikes. Many told me that they survived such hardship and almost made it out with families only to lose all their loved ones in a strike before they had time to flee," unquote. So, remember when this happened?
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
As a reaction to this,
Today we've had a national tragedy. Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country.
Regardless of this,
what did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing.
We've been talking on this show about the various ways in which this administration will seize upon a national shock in order to enact the more insidious parts of their agenda, strip the people of their power, and crush any opposition, etc. We thought the Patriot Act was bad. Just wait until Donald, Bannon, and Jeff Bosesh fulfill their dream board agenda and get a shot at it. There are many ways a government can respond to a terrorist attack. They can ban outdoor activity, restrict the media, infringe on privacy, insert military into our everyday lives, round up large groups of people, clamp down on freedom of speech, the right to protest, arrest those who would organize a protest or opposition, and the media. Good luck. The most lethal way, however? It seemingly won't matter if the country is responsible for the attack or not. We have a Muslim ban right now that targets countries that are not connected to terrorist attacks on our shores. Donald has a grab bag of countries in which he could, if he so choose to, go to war with. They include, but by no means are limited to, Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and most perilously, Iran. And then there's, of course, North Korea.
Let me be very clear. The policy of strategic patience has ended. We're exploring a new range of diplomatic, security, and economic measures. All options are on the table.
That's our Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, T-Rex, who has criticized the U.S. sanctions on Russia and was awarded Russia's Order of Friendship by Putin in 2013, who is also in the news right now because the Treasury fined ExxonMobil $2 million for violating sanctions that the Obama administration imposed on Russian entities in 2014 over Russia's annexation of Crimea, which, were we not living in the upside down, would be a news-dominating scandal for weeks. But
thanks to the goddamn Electoral College handing a
corrupt bigot the presidency, it is an afterthought. If that, anyhow, there are all kinds of reasons why people around Donald would want to go to war, particularly those who came straight from the defense sector, like our potential new Secretary of the Army, in addition to the fact that we have a
crazy lunatic 70-year-old man, baby.
Thank you, Anna DeVaro, in charge of the missiles and desperate for praise.
I think it is amazing optics.
This could be good for infrastructure spending, could be good for tax reform, could be good for health reform in the future. So it can maybe kind of unite the country a little bit more.
We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, "I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons." And they are beautiful pictures of fearsome armaments making what is for them a brief flight over to this airfield.
Again, that followed the strike against Syria in April after the
stunt, a glorified fireworks show which did nothing to impede the Assad regime from using, again, chemical weapons against its own people. It was a stunt that did nothing to impede the Trump regime from using, again, propaganda weapons against its own people.
Thank you, Keith Olbermann. And recognize that the strike was ordered without congressional approval and therefore illegal, according to some experts. Yet senators, Republican and Democrat alike, fell all over themselves to praise him as well.
We fired what is reported to be $94 million worth of missiles, and we didn't even put a hole in the runways. And nobody noticed, because 79 senators publicly said this stunt, this meaningless, dangerous, cynical, exploitative, bullshit stunt that didn't even slow Assad's bombers down was a good thing.
His inner circle also immediately seized on the opportunity and pointed to the attacks as proof that there was nothing untoward going on between the White House and Russia.
Right.
But there is more to this possibility of war that ultimately boils down to a trigger for many wars. If it's not religion, it's oil. Gas Goliaths, like Exxon, have seen their profits plummet since the price of gas has gone down. So when you take T-Rex Tillerson, who, again, I can't say enough, was at Exxon for 41 years, his entire working life, and ExxonMobil has agreed to pay him a retirement package worth a staggering $180 million. And then take Russia. Donald's cuddle buddy, Vladimir Putin's Russia, is little else economically than a vast petrostate. After Saudi Arabia, Russia is the world's leading exporter of natural gas and the second largest exporter of oil. What we have here is a bitter incentive for war. There is no faster or more effective way to drive up the price of oil, especially if that war is in an oil-producing country. Oilprice.com explains that in July 2008, oil prices reached over $136 a barrel due to global concerns that the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the main reasons that oil prices rose so precipitously during the time period was due to the fact that suppliers were unable to convince buyers that they would be able to properly deliver the oil. In comparison, today, oil is going for under $50 per barrel, if not $30 a barrel. Russia has been in an economic crisis since the price of oil collapsed, and the shirtless strongman's weakness is revealed. You might have heard about that little half-a-trillion-dollar deal that the Russian bear and our T-Rex made together, Putin and Tillerson. Around 2012, when T-Rex was with Exxon and made a deal to drill in the Arctic that suffered an early death because of mean Obama's sanctions against Russia. Now, we know our current president would lift those sanctions yesterday if he could, and it remains a constant possibility. So, let's say he did. The deal was made when oil prices were soaring, and these days, not so much. Arctic drilling is expensive. Experts estimate it to cost about $75 per barrel to drill in the Arctic. So gas prices would need to be going over $100 per barrel, if not more, to make the effort worthwhile. Something environmentalists and I have found solace in. But all of this leads us to a pretty grim conclusion indeed. The possibility of war may be better characterized as an inevitability. The U.S. Geological Society estimates that there could be 90 billion barrels of oil beneath the Arctic Ocean. Once Donald takes this country to war, he will trigger a global feeding frenzy for new high-risk, high-carbon fossil fuel extraction from the Arctic to the tar sands, bringing about a climate calamity that is sure to take us past the tipping point. Averting war is in a very real way a climate change issue. Yeah, funny enough, in the end, Donald going to war over oil and profit may be the most presidential thing he has done after all.
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing!
Naomi Klein, who wrote The Shock Doctrine, has advice on how to fight against this administration should a national shock occur, such as a terror attack or war. The first step is knowing what's coming. The second step was to defy the bans he were to put out. If he says not to protest and not to go in the street, we go in those streets. And here is the third step.
Know your history. Throughout U.S. history, national crises have been used to suspend constitutional protections and attack basic rights. After the Civil War, with the nation in crisis, the promise of 40 acres and a mule to freed slaves was promptly betrayed. In the midst of the pain and panic of the Great Depression, as many as 2 million people of Mexican descent were expelled from the United States. After the Pearl Harbor attacks, around 120,000 Japanese Americans were jailed in internment camps. If an attack on U.S. soil were perpetrated by people who were not white and Christian, we can be pretty damn sure that racists would have a field day. And the good folks of Manchester recently showed us how to respond to that.
People in Manchester don't stand with your xenophobia and racism.
The great John Lewis, congressman from Georgia, who nearly died fighting for civil rights, had this to say about activism and resistance to the Washington Post. Quote, "The moment I was first placed under arrest at a sit-in, I felt free. I felt liberated. I felt like I'd crossed over. That this is not just the moment for this day or next week or next year, but a way of life. There is something that I call the spirit of history. Sometimes you're tracked down by a force and you cannot turn away. So I never thought about saying, I'm tired, I'm ready to drop out. You have to continue to pick them up and put them down because there's so much work to be done and you never know how much time you have. And you have to use your time wisely." Unquote. Thank you for listening to my 50th episode. You can find my show on crabdiving.com. That's one word, crabdiving.com, under the K-Voice tab. Listen to the other great programming on the Crab Diving Network. You can also download my show as a podcast, wherever it is you get your podcast. And now you can also find my show on Citizen Truth at citizentruth.org. Follow me on Twitter at KellyTheVoice or on Facebook at K-Voice of Resistance. Okay, take care of yourselves out there. And as always, resist.